because that's how I feel.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so we'll continue for a bit more. And forgive me for sounding like a broken record, but actually I don't actually really make much of an apology for it, because I really see the Buddha was such a person of repetition. And I really realize that the point of it, you know, is that we have to hear something, we hear it, and we hear it, and we hear it, and we hear it, and then at some point the light bulb goes on and we say, oh yeah, that I remember it, you know. So when we're talking about the cultivation of the wholesome, please remember these things. They are virtues. These are the most noble way of being in the world, the cultivation of the wholesome and the skillful. They are virtues of the most noble way of being in the world. And on some place within ourselves, we know this. They leave no residues. They leave no echoes of regret. They lead to safe and trusting relationships and communities and families. So they are virtues. They are already present within our hearts and minds as seeds of potentiality. They are the fruitions of the path. If we want to look at what the awakened mind looks like, it is the fruition of the wholesome and the liberating in an unshakable way. Okay, so they are the fruitions of the path, which is why when I began this weekend, I really equated embodiment with nirvana, because they are the fruitions of these qualities. But for fruition, obviously, to come into being, there needs to be cultivation. We could wait for a very long time to have our own, collision with the unconditioned. We actually need those cultivations, okay? And fruition is the outcome. So it's always looking together at how these sit side by side in our own minds and in our own experience, because we're not talking about something that occurs somewhere else. You know, we're actually talking about the human condition, you know, which is why the Buddha was so non-judgmental most of the time. When he did his tirades about foolish people. But we are speaking about the human condition. So in a way, there's this curious dilemma, isn't it, about how to take this all quite personally, in the sense of how is this actually operating within my personal world, and how to take it quite impersonally at the same time, in terms of actually seeing this operates without that triggering a whole new realm of self-making and judgment and blame and shame. Because if we don't know how to do that, it's very hard to go into these investigations, because the moment we take it too personally through identification, we're probably going to go right over into the work model again. And the becoming model again. So looking again at the roots, the roots of our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. So greed, as I mentioned yesterday, it's a terribly big word. It feels very weighty, you know, and it doesn't feel like I'm always greedy. But it's not about gross pursuit of money. It's an appetite. It's the appetite of insufficiency. It's the appetite of insufficiency. So greed, as I mentioned already a number of times, is always so tied into avidya, it's always so tied into ignorance, of believing myself to be the centralized self that actually can never have enough, can never be enough. That there's always a sense of something missing or lacking. And this is a kind of the core problem of that underlies greed, isn't it? There is something missing or lacking in me, in my life, in how I am, in what I experience, and what I have. And so greed is an embodiment. Greed is an embodiment of the belief in insufficiency and then the discontent. And, you know, it happens so fast. It happens in very little ways. It happens in very big ways, you know. Whether it's, we go outside and we you smell the donuts baking, you know, and how quick we get to that place of, I need one of those. You know, and what can happen from that? I mean, it's a very inane example, you know, but what can happen from that? I could spend the next hour thinking about it, you know, or strategizing about making detours on my way home, and I've got my own favorite donut shop, you know. We're just there, isn't it? It's so easily triggered, that sense of insufficiency, you know, somebody asks a question in the hall, and gosh, I wish I could ask such a good question. You know, why can't I ask such a good question? You know? It's also the greed of becoming, you know? And we see what happens. I mean, you see it every time, you know, we kind of step outside, how our sense doors are on the prowl. You know? Something to see, something to look at, something to satisfy, something to deliver. So we're often looking at the world through the eyes of self-referential judgment, which is the most subtle kind of greed. Self-referential judgment with looking at the world through what it means to me in its capacity to satisfy me. So that's good, that's beautiful, you look very interesting. The kind of self-referential judgment where we are really defining the world in its relationship to its capacity to deliver to me and for me. Is that clear, that kind of self-referential judgment? You know, and there's a whole history behind that too, isn't there? There's the history of perception and the associations with perception, but the way that we're designating the world in terms of being an ally or an enemy, a potential satisfier or a potential depleter. What will make me happy, what's worth pursuing, and of course this is generally around the pleasant, isn't it? Generally around the pleasant, as we mentioned yesterday, the unpleasant doesn't do a lot to really support my sense of self. But the pleasant does quite a bit. So coexisting, and I mentioned this yesterday, how greed and aversion are coexisting. You know, greed is the abandonment of one thing, this is not enough, I need something else. You know, aversion is saying, I don't like this, I need to go somewhere else. You know, so they're always cooperating. And it is the embodiment of fear. It is again self-referential. What will intrude upon me? What will threaten me? What will deplete me? What I need to defend against? And of course, when there is considerable aversion, there is a culture of doubt. Mostly because, as I mentioned yesterday, many of these activities are operationally ineffective. They don't work. So then there's a culture of doubt. There's no steady ground to stand upon. That fears no loss. So I can never, it seems, make the right decision, you know, or do I do this or do I do that? And doubt is so much the outcome of operational ineffectiveness. When craving and aversion don't work. And creating the other. You know, aversion and greed are constantly, through that self-referential judgment, creating the other. The other who might threaten me, disturb me, the other that I posit within it the capacity to satisfy me, to make me happy. The other which, is my enemy or my friend. The other sometimes, of course, is created inwardly, within the body, experiences we can't embrace, within the emotions we feel ashamed of. And there's a lot of agitation. Of course, we can't ignore that. You know, greed and aversion are busy creatures. You know, they're endlessly trying to rearrange the world of conditions. So there's always a sense of agitation, you know, somehow being on the move. You know, we have a lot to do. Well, we have a lot to work on, of course. Now, the third one of delusion, you know, so I simply describe delusion as the arguments we have with the unarguables. It's just delusion. The arguments we have with the unarguables. The arguments we have with impermanence, you know, the arguments that we have with how things actually are in this moment, the argument that says, you know, it can't be like this, it shouldn't be like this, I shouldn't be like this. It's living in this state of argument, seeing solidity when there's only process. So let's just go onto that other side of looking at the roots of all the skillful, wise, healing, and liberating intentions that shape skillful, healing, liberating thoughts, speech, and actions. And understanding, yes, these roots are latent, they're seeds of potentiality, but they are cultivations and they are commitments. Non-greed, what does that look like? What does that look like for you to abide in a place of non-greed? First of all, there's a lot of calmness. You know, because the agitation doesn't have a root. It's much more calm. You know, and you see how the Buddha constantly encourages this cultivating, calm abiding in the midst of all things. Cultivating calm abiding in the midst of all things. But there's more than this. There is contentment. You know, and I think of this when, you know, when I look at the monastic life, which is not our life. But when I think of the first teaching of the monastic life, it's around contentment. You know, to be content with whatever food you're given, or even if you're given none. You know, to be content with whatever clothing you're given, or even if you're given none. You know, contentment to be content with whatever accommodation you're offered, or even if you're ever offered none. And to find joy and contentment in the falling away of the unskillful. Now, you know, of course, in our minds we think, well, that's hunky-dory for monastics, you know, they're signing up for this. You know, but it's actually saying, you know, that this is actually what makes the difference between in a monastic life between that being a life of sufficiency or a life of deprivation. And I think when we look at that, then we actually really look at how would that actually apply to our lives as lay people. You know, to be content with whatever food I'm given, or even if I'm given none. To be content with whatever clothing I have, or even if I'm given none. Well, that wouldn't be socially acceptable. But to be content with whatever accommodation I'm offered, or even if I'm given none. It applies actually to the moment, doesn't it? To be content with what is here. It's a huge reorientation of the mind, you know? And I think in our lives it is a movement from insufficiency to sufficiency, you know? I actually have what I need in this moment, everything, for generosity, for kindness, for well-being. You know, even if there's a million things not quite correct in my life, in this moment, can I rest in that sense of sufficiency? Now, obviously there's a near enemy to this, you know, which is a kind of endurance and, you know, lack of aspiration and lack of creativity. There's a near enemy to contentment, which is a kind of resignation, okay? But this is actually not what we're speaking about. We're actually really looking at our own mind and heart and how much they are governed and determined and shaped by the world of conditions. That's what we're really actually looking at. And that is, of course, the shift that is really suggested in the monastic teachings of contentment. And I think it's a shift that's really asked for in the teachings of contentment in any life that really doesn't wish to live in a way in which the state of our mind is constantly being shaped and determined by conditions that we often cannot control. It's a Does anybody have any thoughts about that that need to be voiced? This is counterculture. You know, almost every message we receive in our day says, don't go there. Our retail industry would collapse, you know, our economy would suffer, you know, people would lose their jobs. But it's not about that, and it's certainly not about resignation. But it's about how much are we feeding the hungry ghost? You know, and as an embodiment, as an intention, as a commitment, I think it's so important to have a sense of what does that look like as a practice and as a pathway and as a commitment to and as an embodiment, and where is it cultivated? You know, it's not, I mean, mostly it's cultivated, isn't it? In all those moments when we feel the stirrings, it says, you know, I don't have enough, I'm not enough, I just need this, I just need to reach out, if I could just rearrange that. And I think it's important to consider, what does this look like as a cultivation, as a commitment? You know, what would change in our lives? Is there something that's going round and round? Oh, all right, okay. It's a warning that they're in danger. Okay, very helpful. Okay. Sweet. Did somebody have their hand up? When you actually personally have that sense of sufficiency, the thought arises that it's not enough. Yes. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
So what do you do with that thought? There's different possibilities here. I mean, one is that that thought is simply residual habit. You know, that just says, oh, okay, sufficiency, that's enough. The other is that, you know, I would encourage you to actually really investigate the sense of sufficiency. How does that feel in the body? How does that feel in the mind? How, you know, what is my felt sense of that? Because we have those moments, don't we? We certainly have those moments, you know, where it's just enough, that there's nothing lacking. And yet very easily we kind of gloss over them because, you know, they're, and I think sometimes the habitual residue that arises is the craving for intensity. You know, I think that can be very much part of the fabric of insufficiency. You know, but it's not very exciting. I have nothing to work on. You know, I have nothing to figure out. I have nothing to get. You know, I've got nothing to go for. You know, there must be something wrong with this. you know, I'm not leaning forward into the next moment. There must be something wrong with this. So I think sometimes that's a certain tension in our experience that, you know, intensity is you know, I think now the fourth biggest dimension of craving in our culture. Defines competency, defines adequacy, defines being someone special, you know, defines becoming someone. I didn't see it so much in the Buddha's time, you know, because they were just busy getting on with surviving. You know, that intensity and thrill was obviously an optional extra. You don't hear many sutras about people going out to look for the tigers. You know, the tigers were already there, you know. It's, can I only have to go look for a tiger in order to feel awake? So I think sometimes it's really good to investigate what that, you know, whether it's just a habit or whether it's a sense that we have not really actually really nurtured and developed and brought to fruition and found such a sense of ease within that, those little moments of sufficiency that appear in our day. And, you know, I don't think they're strangers to anyone. You know, I mean, I do often feel that the great genius of the Buddha was to build upon what we already know.
I appreciate the awareness of the sufficiency and your acknowledgement that it's not resignation. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more.
Well, I do think it's very important always to be mindful of the near enemies, the kind of shadow sides of these qualities, because I don't know of a single ennobling quality that the Buddha speaks about that doesn't have a near enemy. And, you know, sufficiency is alive, it's dynamic, it's wakeful, it's joyful. I don't think resignation has any of those characteristics. Resignation is the big sigh, isn't it? That's how it is. You know, it's the big sigh. And so I think it's really so qualitatively different that we learn to spot those differences. And, you know, resignation is often a surrender of aspiration, where sufficiency is actually the ground of so many other wholesome aspirations, you know, of generosity, of you know, service, of communication, of compassion, of reaching out, celebration, appreciation. If somebody's in danger, they've been in danger for a long time. Non-greed, I think, is an inner trust. And I think it's learning to rest and learning to be at peace with what we cannot control. Learning to be at peace with what we cannot control. And, you know, I think there's a part in our lives where we actually need to acknowledge coexistence. You know, that calm can coexist with, you know, flurries of agitation, that peace can coexist in, you know, situations that are seemingly out of control. They're not opposites, you know, they're not opposites. And, you know, so if we think about the conditions of coming to wise intention, you know, restraint is part of cultivating sufficiency, isn't it? I mean, restraint is such an antidote to impulse, and it's not popular, and it's not easily comes, doesn't come easily to us, you know. I remember I was teaching in Italy earlier this year, and I was giving a talk on renunciation, and restraint being the forerunner of renunciation, and the translator just stopped. I asked if there was a problem, and every word in Italian that seemed that they could find for renunciation had some implication of suppression. had some implication of compartmentalizing, of suppressing, of you know, muting, of pushing down, where of course in the training of liberation, restraint is central. Learning to bring in those mindful pauses before the speech, before the actions, learning that to actually know the energetic feeling of impulse and to be able to pause. To be able to pause in the energetic moments of impulse. And again, it is a practice, and it is a practice we get better at. As with all things, peacemaking is one of the conditions of skillful intention embodiment. And you know, when the Buddha speaks about peacemaking, he often uses the pathway of learning to free ourselves from indebtedness. Indebtedness. And you know, he used the simile of thinking about what it's like to be financially in debt and owing money and the weight and the burden and the agitation of that. But he wasn't talking about financial debt, he was talking about emotional debt. What we are not at peace with. And it doesn't take us long to figure that one out. Just look at what your attention keeps going to. You know, look at the loops. Look at the loops. This is what we are not at peace with. And when the Buddha speaks about peacemaking and freeing the mind from indebtedness, it wasn't a one-dimensional action. Sometimes it meant outer action, and sometimes it makes making peace with that which is unfinished and cannot be finished. Speaks about the cultivation of appreciation and practicing generosity as an antidote to aversion. Speaks about mindfulness generating an inwardly generated aliveness as an antidote to delusion. Training of our own minds and hearts to discover inwardly generated joy as an antidote to greed. So we laid the grounds for wise intention. Again, these don't, you know, the intentions of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, they do not arise from nowhere. It's actually laying the ground, preparing the conditions for those intentions to arise. And we get into the short list of skillful intentions. Let's put them into a different language. Non-aversion, kindness, compassion. You know, when the Buddha speaks about the three wise intentions, non-aversion, kindness, compassion. Non-greed, generosity. Non-delusion, letting go, renunciation. Now, I want to really speak about these intentions, and I want to speak about this intention of kindness and compassion, because in Buddhist psychology these are really not separated. The compassion is a continuation of metta, and that the metta is the foundation of all of the Brahma-viharas. All of you familiar with the Brahma-viharas? Anyone not? Okay, unshakable kindness, unshakable compassion, unshakable joy, unshakable equanimity. Now, of these, of course, it is only metta, unshakable kindness, that warrants its own dedicated discourse. The other qualities are really said to be arisen from metta, but they're not grouped together in and maybe one other discourse. But metta is the one that's really given the big weight. Because if you untangle one of the threads of unskillful intention, of greed, hatred, and delusion, the others dissolve. And the place that we can start is metta. It's a really big subject. And this is something I've been really working with. Hard to get that word out. Reflecting on, investigating, exploring for several years now. And if I could just give you a brief potted history of this. The translation of metta is boundless befriending. Okay, it's a verb. It's not a state. It's boundless befriending. It has its roots in the word maitri, which is to be a friend to, which has its roots in an earlier word, which actually means to translates as to grow fat with kindness. Now, the Buddha actually, clearly did not teach metta as a concentration practice. Otherwise, metta would have only a very band-aid effect upon aversion. The Buddha taught metta as a way of freeing the mind from aversion, from ill will, to a place where it comes to fruition and is unshakable, which means that aversion and ill will have gone. They have gone. Now, a funny, strange, I think actually really rather tragic phenomena happened in my understanding over the development of the Dharma in the years following the early, after the Buddha's death. And it had something to do with, the endeavors to ensure that the Buddha's teachings were somehow retained, and one of those ways of retaining the Buddha's teaching was to try and codify them, put them into lots of lists, the establishment of kind of academies, universities of learning within the Buddhist world. And within that development after the Buddha's death, and there's a lot more to it than that, metta became a poor cousin to insight. Whereas in the early texts, if one looks at them much more closely, metta is entirely dedicated to liberating the heart from all traces of ill will. It is an awakening practice and actually described as being a path to awakening in itself. This kind of got forgotten for quite a while. And then when metta reappeared about 1,000 years after the Buddha's death, I think the scholars of those times actually didn't quite know what to do with it, so it got put into a concentration section, where it's actually remained ever since, certainly in Theravadan orthodoxy. I'm waiting for the thunderbolts. The thunderbolts to come. And this is how Westerners have inherited metta as a concentration practice. As a way of focus, and it can be used as a concentration practice, by the way, and used quite skillfully as a concentration practice. And as a concentration practice, metta does act and serve as a guardian of the mind, a protector of the mind, but it's a guardian, because all of concentration is a guardian of the mind that protects the mind from the power of impulse. And so in metta practice particularly protects the mind from the power of obsession and rumination. So it's very useful as a concentration practice, but I think there's much more to it than this. And I think in terms when we look at embodiment, if you want to actually look at the landscape of an awakened mind, you will look for the embodiment of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You will look for the embodiment of that. This is the kind of landscape of awakening. It's not something nice, secondary. This is the landscape of awakening. This is the fruition of awakening is the embodiment of immeasurable metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You know, so this is actually what we're going for. This is what we're cultivating. This is a way, and as an insight practice, all of these qualities hold within them the capacity to uproot greed, hatred, and delusion. You don't actually have to go somewhere else. Because can you imagine actually really cultivating unshakable, boundless kindness without insight? What would you have? You would have a state. If you're embodying something that's going to be unshakable in all moments and all situations, it cannot be separated from insight, in my understanding. So I think for some people in the West, it's very important to actually have a slight reorientation. You know, and if we're actually looking at awakening, what does it mean for us to embody these qualities that begin with the embodiment of unshakable befriending? What is the inside aspect of metta, of befriending? It is to uproot aversion. And see the continuum, you know, see the continuum. Because what is the impulse, the reflex of aversion? It's to turn away from what's present, isn't it? It's to separate, it's to disconnect, it's to make a distance. So this is where mindfulness and metta are going hand in hand, because if we were to say that there is an impulse of mindfulness, it is to turn towards. It is to turn towards what is being experienced. And then the metta that goes hand in hand with mindfulness is the willingness to stand near to what is being experienced, to stand close to it, with the willingness to befriend, to befriend. This is a rotation of the mind. It's a radical rotation of the mind. But it is actually the pathway of uprooting aversion. It is why I don't anymore use the phrase loving kindness. I meet too many people who feel exiled from the pathway of cultivating metta because they don't know how to love their chronic illness, or they don't know how to love, you know, their grief, or they don't know how to love, you know, the impossibly intractable person in their life, you know. And so they feel, well, you know, I can't do it. You know, metta is not part of my pathway because I can't love this. And I'm supposed to experience some sort of state of loving kindness. But actually, when they think about it as an insight practice, no, I can't love this. I don't even like this. But maybe I can stand next to it. Maybe I can stand next to it. Maybe I can stand next to that chronic pain or illness. Maybe I can stand next to that difficult mind state, you know, or that afflictive emotion. Or maybe I can stand near to that person who seems so intractably difficult. Maybe there's a way of being of non-abandonment. And in the Metta Sutta, of course, in the early translation, the Buddha describes metta as a quality of sati, a quality of mindfulness, and actually uses exactly the same phrasing. You know, whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, this is the most noble way of being in this world. So clearly, in those words, what is being suggested is an attitudinal commitment. It's almost a behavioral gesture of the mind, but it is also a cultivation, whether sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. Those who remain in this recollection, those who abide in this recollection of metta, cultivate the most noble way of being in this world. So Anybody have any thoughts about that? I've just banished another phrase from your vocabulary. Meditation's gone, loving kindness is gone. Probably to return later on today, but there we are. Yes. I don't know if there's anything really particularly to define, except, you know, I have a deep inner commitment to learning, and I feel very privileged to be spend a lot of time with other people who have a very deep inner commitment to learning. And of late, I have been spending much more time with the early texts, pre-Theravadan canon, and found it quite illuminating. And finding it actually quite clarifying, you know, in terms of my own personal practice and pathways and cultivations. Befriending. Please put this into a verb form. You know, because I feel that one of the great hitches or snags people come across is that I actually feel aversive, you know, or I feel afraid, or, you know, I feel resistant. That's okay. I can stand near to that. You know, I can stand next to that. I can stand near to aversion. I can befriend aversion. It doesn't have to go away. It doesn't have to be so dichotomized that I'm either abiding in metta or I'm abiding in aversion. This is where we find there can be coexistence. I can befriend aversion. I can explore the landscape of aversion. I can explore it in the body. I can explore it in the mind. I can learn a way of not being intimidated by aversion or ill will, that I can both turn towards and stand near to with that befriending. And, you know, in terms of formal practices, I mean, clearly the way that most people have inherited metta is from the Visuddhimagga, which was, you know, created, you know, some thousand years after the Buddha's death, you know, where we use these human categories, you know, of self, benefactor, friend, neutral person, difficult person, all beings. This is very skillful means. I think it's great. It's very skillful means. Of course, it's not in the Metta Sutta. If we went to the Metta Sutta, we would be using the categories of those who are short, those who are tall, those who are big, those who are small. You know, we would be using quite different categories. So it's very skillful means. It's very helpful, because it opens the doorways to what these different domains of human relationship actually do trigger in terms of impulse and greed and hatred and delusion. It opens those doorways. We also learn in those categories, you know, what it means not to only have an external benefactor, but to reflect on what it means to be a benefactor to ourselves. Not only to have an external friend, what it means to be a friend to ourselves, not only what it means to have a difficult person in our life, but the way that we can be a difficult person for ourselves. So there's a lot of skillful means within those categories. But if we actually consider aversion does not arise only in the domains of human relationship. There's plenty, you know, this is a free range impulse, isn't it? In anything that triggers unpleasantness, fear, whatever, selfing, you know, aversion arises. So, you know, there can be plenty of aversion for the other, you know, whether it's an illness, a pain, a difficult sound, you know, a difficult situation, a loss, a grief, in a frustration, a disappointment. There are so many places where aversion can arise. And if we were to formally cultivate metta in those moments, we would, and using form is good, because using form is the way that we plant and replant the seeds of intention over and over again. So if we were to formally practice metta as an insight practice in relationship to aversion, we cultivate it, of course, wherever aversion arises, ill will, impatience, you know, the whole spectrum. But we would need to change the phrases, obviously, because it makes no sense at all, does it, as an insight practice. If I'm sitting, I'm visualizing my benefactor, my back is killing me, and there's so much aversion to what's going on there, and I keep coming, trying to keep coming back to my benefactor, which is, you know, a fabricated image, obviously. The actuality, I'm hating what's going on in my back. Clearly, the metta needs to come to that present moment experience where aversion is arising. And then the phrases need to change, because they need to become very relational. So we're not talking about a state, imagining a state of kindness while, you know, somehow separate from what's going on. We need to make the form of the practice relational to what is being experienced. So, you know, my suggestion in a situation like that is, you know, if I was using phrases, for example, as a form of the practice, may I be peaceful in the midst of this? May I cultivate ease and kindness in the midst of this pain? So it's making it very relational, and it's sowing that seed of intentionality, the capacity to befriend what is actually being experienced, and allowing that to ease the grip of the aversion, the rejection, the resistance, and to befriend the difficult. This is what takes so much fear out of our life, because we are intimidated by the unpleasant. And so we are prone to abandon it. And, you know, this can be a very useful exploration, because, you know, clearly in this sense we are really cultivating understanding. We're cultivating the understanding of aversion and what it means to be free of aversion in that moment. So as an insight practice, it's fulfilling all of those things. It is a blessing. It is an intention that is being cultivated. You know, it is eventually a fruition. But it's very present moment located, not after this goes away. Well, it can be hijacked into aversive modes. You know, may I be peaceful? You know. It can be hijacked into that, and many people struggle with metta as a cultivation, which is why I'm encouraging you to reframe it. Because if you use metta as a cultivation practice, you would use the phrases very repetitively and continuously, because that's what's guarding the mind from being gripped by obsession. If you were using metta as an insight practice, you would allow much more stillness. You would allow a lot of pauses in between the phrases, because the phrases are only serving as reminders of the intentionality. And in the pauses, you would listen inwardly. May I be peaceful in the midst of this? To listen inwardly. What kind of echoes arise? What kind of responses arise? If the mind becomes forgetful, if the attention becomes forgetful, then you renew the phrase. but you allow much more space because it's that listening inwardly. You know, if I use the phrase, may I be peaceful inwardly, and I listen, I actually get a sense of where there's no peace. And can there be a befriending of that? You know? So you allow much more stillness in the practice. As a concentration practice, it needs that continuity in order to protect the mind from obsession. But it does create a lot of busyness. Yes. Yes.
Is this an inside job?
sometimes it's both, you know. I mean, think of having a commitment to dying without any enemies. And what would be needed to be cultivated for that to happen? You know, if I think of that in my life, there may be one or two people I need to apologize to. They may have moved on, they're on vacation in Florida, and there's nothing I can do outwardly. Then I need to make peace with my own sense of regret, my own sense of forgiveness can be a big piece of this. Equanimity can be a big piece of this, of recognizing how much is not in our hands to control or fix. But think of the commitment to dying without any enemies. And seeing as that could happen in 5 minutes' time, I cannot afford indebtedness. You know, our minds cannot afford obsession and repetition and loop making and indebtedness. You know, they're saboteurs of well-being. They're saboteurs of freedom. They're saboteurs of, you know, harmonious relationships. You know, we just can't afford it, is my sense. I mean, it looks juicy sometimes, you know. I mean, we can be in love with our feuds, you know. We can imagine taking that argument to the grave and there's a certain juice in it, you know. It can be generational, you know. We're hoping somebody else is going to continue the feud after we're gone, you know. But there's no freedom in it.
Is that and life does present situations where it's unsafe to get forgiveness, there are dangerous people.
Yeah.
Then it is.
And then it's an internal.
And that's just making the call.
It's making peace with my own turmoil and recognizing that I have done everything that is possible to do. And now this is the time for completing that which is incomplete. Well, the Buddha, you know, so much used the metaphor of fire making. You know, if you want a fire to burn, just keep throwing logs on it. You know, and it'll burn. You know, it's that simple. If you don't keep throwing logs on it, it's going to sputter out. What are the logs? That's an investigation, you know. It's certainly our thoughts, it's our clinging, it's our need for satisfaction, it's our need to be justified, whatever it is. It's good to identify our own logs, you know. And this is maybe, you know, where some restraint initially is cultivated, you know, a pregnant pause, and maybe we see there's a lot more happiness in not throwing the logs on the fire. You know, and we have trust in that restraint, and we become more less willing to keep throwing the logs on the fire, because why would I volunteer for suffering? It's a Nagarjuna says, you know, what do you do with a life that doesn't go away? I would either befriend it or... There's a lot of other... I mean, we didn't pay for this to happen, by the way, but it's quite clearly one of those very clear life examples, isn't it? I could do a lot with that. It's kind of an open door, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I could do what's needed, go check that nobody's in danger, and then when I've done what's needed, it's kind of like I've done what's needed, and now what's needed is actually, what do I do with a life that doesn't go away? I could befriend it. Yes. Okay, let's put it in different language, the foundations. Okay, the first foundation of mindfulness, remember the four channels I was talking about? You know, and they're always broadcasting, they're always interfacing, but we switch on to one more than the other. So the first foundation is somatic, the experience of the body. The second foundation is what is called hedonic, that feeling tone of experience. The third foundation is affective. This is our emotional tone, moods, mental states. And the fourth channel is within, generally within, what is called the cognitive. But the affective and the cognitive, of course, are really overlapping. So this is all our kind of thought process contents. Yes. This goes actually within a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people would say this goes within the fourth foundation. Now, the translation of the Satipatthana that most people are used to looking at is, of course, the Pali version, in which you see a lot of lists. Now, in terms of the congruence between the Pali and the Sanskrit and Chinese, the only congruence is within the presentation of the hindrances, which are mental, psychological factors that are called, you know, that are pretty obscuring. And the factors of awakening. Those are the only two congruent lists. So, you know, I tend to have a little bit of trust in that because it seems to me like that holds the important stuff in terms of the Satipatthanas. Mm-hmm.